Chapter 5. Fermenting Vegetables, and Some Fruits, Too. There is an underlying unity to all vegetable fermentation. By keeping vegetables submerged under liquid, you can create a selective environment where molds and other oxygen-dependent organisms cannot grow, thereby encouraging acidifying bacteria. Beyond this simple technique and all the particulars of what, where, when, and how, approaches to vegetable fermentation can be quite varied and quirky. Some traditions wilt vegetables, either in saltwater brine or in the sun. Others pound or bruise fresh vegetables. Some people ferment a single vegetable, while others mix a dozen different vegetables together, perhaps along with spices, fruit, fish, rice, mashed potatoes, or other additions. Some people ferment theirs for just a few days, others for weeks, months, or even years. Some ferment in sealed jars, others in open crocks, others in specially designed vessels. Some ferment in cellars or buried crocks, others on balconies or in garages. Still others right on their kitchen counters. Some ferment in the protection of darkness, others directly in the sun. Most traditions work with the bacteria native to the vegetables. Some add various starters. There is no single way of accomplishing this task that has been so widely interpreted in varied regions by different cultural traditions and incorporated into infinite unique secret family recipes, passed down through the generations with periodic adjustments and adaptations. Fermenting vegetables is the ideal way to begin a fermentation practice in your life. It is very easy, it can be enjoyed fairly quickly, it is extremely nutritious and beneficial to health, it is delicious and a satisfying accompaniment to any meal, and it is intrinsically safe. Sometimes people are afraid to try fermentation for fear of accidentally getting the wrong bacteria growing and potentially sickening or even killing themselves and others. At least in the realm of raw plant materials, this fear is unfounded. As far as I know, there has never been a documented case of foodborne illness from fermented vegetables, states Fred Bright, a microbiologist for the U.S. Department of Agriculture, who specializes in vegetable fermentation. Risky is not a word I would use to describe vegetable fermentation. It is one of the oldest and safest technologies we have. In light of recent outbreaks of foodborne illnesses traced to spinach, lettuce, tomatoes, and other raw vegetables, I think it would be fair to say that fermented vegetables are safer than raw vegetables. For even given some freak incident of contamination, the incidental pathogenic bacteria could never compete with the native lactic acid bacteria populations, and the acidification that rapidly develops in fermenting vegetables would destroy any surviving pathogens. Lactic acid bacteria offer a strategy for safety and preservation that is present in all vegetation. Some people are concerned about the safety of fermenting garlic because there have been reports of botulism from garlic preserved in olive oil. But preserving a vegetable in olive oil is very different from preserving the same vegetable under water or its own juices. Specifically, the environment becomes far more anaerobic. When garlic is preserved in brine or mixed with other vegetables, botulism is not a concern. If you wish to preserve garlic in olive oil, a simple step to ensure safety is to marinate the garlic in vinegar to acidify it first, thereby making it an inhospitable environment for C. botulinum, the bacteria that produces the botulism toxin. Lactic acid bacteria. Lactic acid bacteria, LAB, most commonly Leuconostic mesenteroides, are found on all plants, though in relatively low numbers, averaging below 1% of plants' microbial populations. As soon as the plant is harvested, the number of microorganisms increases, according to a team of biologists. This is a result of more nutrients becoming available from the cellular contents of ruptured tissue. Besides the increase in total number, the distribution among different types of microorganisms changes. Aerobic bacteria dominant on the living plant are replaced by facultative anaerobes, including various lactic acid bacteria, among them L. mesenteroides. If vegetables are submerged, L. mesenteroides initiates fermentation. L. mesenteroides is described as heterofermentative, meaning that in addition to its primary product, lactic acid, it creates significant quantities of secondary products, including carbon dioxide, alcohol, and acetic acid. Homofermentative LAB are those producing nearly exclusively, at least 85%, lactic acid. The Homo fermentative bacteria are more specialized and are better able to tolerate low pH, high acidity. The noticeably heavy CO2 production in the earliest stages of vegetable fermentation is due to heterofermentative activity. As that activity acidifies the environment, the population shifts toward acid-tolerant homofermentative LAB, such as Lactobacillus plantarum, which characterize later stages of vegetable ferments. The success of the sauerkraut fermentation depends primarily upon the symbiotic relationships of the heterofermentative and homofermentative lactobacilli. A critical aspect of the action of lactic acid bacteria is its self-protection. The lactic acid they produce is effective in inhibiting the growth of other bacteria that may decompose or spoil the food. According to the United Nations Food and Agriculture Organization report, Fermented Fruits and Vegetables, A Global Perspective. This is why lactic acid fermentation is such an effective strategy for food preservation and safety. LAB are not found exclusively on plants. The lactic acid bacteria are a diverse group of organisms with a diverse metabolic capacity, states the UN report. They are among the first bacteria newborn babies are exposed to in childbirth. Infants continue to have lactic acid bacteria exposure through breastfeeding. Every person in the world has contact with lactic acid bacteria, state a team of microbiologists. From birth, we are exposed to these species through our food and environment. Given the constant assault on our intestinal bacteria by antibacterial chemicals, we need the replenishment of lactic acid bacteria populations and genetics that are present in fermented vegetables and other products of fermentation by lactic acid bacteria. Vitamin C and fermented vegetables. The tradition of preserving vegetables by fermentation became so widespread because in temperate regions of the world, historically, there were no fresh vegetables available in winter. Fermentation of vegetables is primarily a strategy for extending the season by preserving vegetables for winter consumption. Vegetables contain critical nutrients, prime among them vitamin C. Therefore, a balanced winter diet is facilitated by fermentation. Chinese philosopher Confucius wrote in the 6th century B.C., having yan cai, salted vegetables, I can survive the winter. 2 millennia later, the British sailor, Captain James Cook, was famously credited with conquering scurvy, vitamin C deficiency, by bringing barrels of sauerkraut with him to sea and feeding it to his crews daily. While the fermentation process does not contribute additional vitamin C, as it does B vitamins, it does preserve vitamin C by slowing down its loss. A 1938 study undertaken by the New York State Agricultural Experiment Station demonstrated that the loss of vitamin C begins only after the fermentation process has been completed and the production of carbon dioxide has practically ceased. The study concludes that the post-fermentation loss of vitamin C is due more to a loss of the protective atmosphere of carbon dioxide than to any other factor. Even if nutrients are not fully preserved forever, keeping more of them longer is valuable. Krautchi basics. Krautchi is a word I made up, a hybrid of sauerkraut and kimchi, the German and Korean words for fermented vegetables that we have adopted into the English language. The English language does not have its own word for fermented vegetables. It would not be inaccurate to describe fermented vegetables as pickled, but pickling covers much ground beyond fermentation. Pickles are anything preserved by acidity. Most contemporary pickles are not fermented at all. Instead, they rely upon highly acidic vinegar, a product of fermentation, usually heated in order to sterilize vegetables, preserving them by destroying rather than cultivating microorganisms. For pickles, fermentation was the primary means of preservation until the 1940s, when direct acidification and pasteurization of cucumber pickles was introduced, writes Fred Bright of the USDA. My vegetable ferments are usually concoctions that do not fit any homogeneous traditional ideal of either German sauerkraut or Korean kimchi. But of course, everything I've learned about sauerkraut and kimchi reveal that neither of them constitutes a homogeneous tradition. They are highly varied, from regional specialties to family secrets. Nonetheless, certain techniques underlie both, and many other related traditions, and my practice is a rather free-form application of these basic techniques rather than an attempt to reproduce any particular notion of authenticity. In a nutshell, the steps I typically follow when I ferment vegetables are 1. Chop or grate vegetables. 2. Lightly salt the chopped veggies, add more as necessary to taste, and pound or squeeze until moist. Alternatively, soak the veggies in a brine solution for a few hours. 3. Pack the vegetables into a jar or other vessel, tightly, so that they are forced below the liquid. Add water if necessary. 4. Wait, taste frequently, and enjoy. Of course, there is more information and nuance, which the rest of this chapter explores, but really, chop, salt, pack, wait is what most of it amounts to. Chop. Every rule has exceptions. Even though the basic Krautchi process above starts with chop, it is not necessary to chop or grate vegetables in order to ferment them. If vegetables are to be fermented whole or in big chunks, they are typically fermented in saltwater brine, buried in other chopped or grated salted vegetables, or in some other pickling medium. What chopping and grating do is create more surface area, which facilitates pulling juice out of the vegetables so they can be submerged under their own juices. That is our objective. Without exposing surface area, it is impossible to pull juices out of vegetables. The more finely chopped or grated they are, the more surface area is exposed, the faster and easier it is to pull water out of them, and the juicier the vegetables will be. But coarse chopping, or mixed textures, is good too. I usually tell people who help me chop veggies, chopper's choice. Be flexible when you can. Salt. Dry salting versus brining. Like chopping, salt is not absolutely necessary for fermentation. Some traditions of fermenting vegetables, such as those of the Himalayas, mostly ferment vegetables without salt, Himalayan gundruk and sinki. Some people believe, I do not, that vegetables fermented without salt contain more beneficial bacteria than those fermented with salt, and some people have been given a medical directive to avoid salt. Vegetables can be fermented without any salt, but with even a modest amount of salt, ferments generally taste better, maintain a more pleasing texture, and have the potential to ferment longer and more slowly. Salt facilitates vegetable fermentation in a number of different ways. Salt pulls water out of the vegetables through osmosis. This is part of getting the vegetables submerged under their own juices. It makes vegetables crispier by hardening plant cell compounds called pectins and keeps them crispy by slowing the action of pectin, digesting enzymes in vegetables that eventually make vegetables mushy. By creating a selective environment, salt narrows the range of which bacteria can grow, giving the salt-tolerant lactic acid bacteria a competitive advantage. Salt extends the potential for preservation by slowing the fermentation, slowing the pectin-digesting enzymes, and slowing development of surface molds. Since fermented vegetables have been such a critically important food for survival in many cold, temperate places, the fact that salt enhances preservation means that historically, ferments have often been heavily salted. In some traditions, ferments have been salty enough to warrant soaking and rinsing before eating. The problem with this approach is that the soaking leaches not just salt, but other nutrients as well. I do not generally measure the salt when I ferment vegetables, although many people do. I salt lightly as I chop vegetables, then mix together, taste, and add more salt if necessary. It is always easier to add salt than to remove it. Salt can be diluted by adding more vegetables without salt or by adding water. Excess water can be poured off, and with it, salt will be removed. There are two broad methods people use to salt vegetables for fermentation: dry salting and brining. Dry salting is simply sprinkling salt on vegetables. This is the method I use most often. Brining involves mixing salt with water, the mixture is the brine, and submerging vegetables in it. The dry salting method requires that vegetables be chopped or shredded, for only with lots of surface area exposed can the salt pull water out of the vegetables. If vegetables are to be left whole or in large pieces, the brine method is more appropriate. Some traditions use hybrid methods, such as submerging vegetables for a short wilting soak in a strong brine, or heavily dry salting vegetables, leaving them to sweat, then rinsing them to remove excess salt. More on brining to come. For the dry salt method, commercial manufacturers typically work with salt proportions ranging from 1.5% to 2% by weight, or roughly 1.5 to 2 teaspoons of salt per pound, 500 grams, of vegetables. In wild fermentation, I recommended 3 tablespoons of salt per 5 pounds, 2.3 kilograms, of vegetables. Many people have told me they found that to be too salty. Try less. Measuring salt by volume rather than weight is inexact, as different grinds of salt will yield very different weights for a given volume. In considering how much salt to use in your fermented vegetables, it is helpful to understand the dynamics of salt in the fermentation environment. Salt essentially slows fermentation and enzyme activity, and thereby prolongs preservation potential. Temperature also impacts upon the speed of fermentation, which is slower in cool temperatures and faster in warm temperatures. Therefore, in summer heat, I typically use more salt in order to slow down fermentation. In winter, I use less. If I'm fermenting vegetables intending to preserve them for months, I use more salt. If I'm making a batch for an event next week, I use less. Another aspect of salting vegetables for fermentation is what type of salt to use. Not all salts are the same. I typically work with unrefined sea salts containing many trace minerals made bioavailable by the fermentation. Some sources suggest avoiding iodized salts, which can darken vegetables and make brine cloudy. But really, you can ferment vegetables with whatever salt you have on hand. Having had the opportunity to ferment vegetables with every possible kind of salt handed to me by workshop organizers, I have observed that lactic acid bacteria seem tolerant to a wide variety of salts and are not particularly picky. Pounding or squeezing vegetables, or soaking in a brine. Once vegetables are chopped and salted, or not salted if you prefer it that way, bruising them helps to further remove water so that we can submerge them under their own juices. Cells function to hold water. Bruising the vegetables breaks down cell walls and facilitates the release of juices. At a small scale, up to say 5 gallons, 20 liters, I find it easiest and most pleasant to do this by simply squeezing vegetables with my clean hands. I like working with my hands. At my workshops, it's always easy to find enthusiastic volunteers for this job. You can also pound vegetables with a clean, heavy, blunt tool, a baseball bat, a 2x4 board, make sure the wood is not pressure treated, or a specialized tool elegantly crafted for just this purpose. At a large scale, people have often stomped on the vegetables with their feet. Squeeze, pound, or stomp until the vegetables are dripping wet. Pick up a handful and squeeze, and vegetable juice should be expressed. In the Asian tradition, rather than pounding as described above, people typically wilt vegetables by soaking them in brine for a time. This accomplishes the same objective in a different way, with less work but more time and more salt. Vegetables are soaked in salty brine for several hours or longer. Just a few hours in a very salty brine, longer in a moderately salty mix, then drained before mixing with spices. Pack. Once vegetables are nice and moist, through bruising or soaking, they can be further salted or spiced if desired and packed into vessels. Whether you seal them in a jar or ferment them in a crock, stuff vegetables into the vessel tightly so that air pockets are forced out and liquid rises, submerging the vegetables. If the vegetables are not fully submerged, press hard on them a few times to see if you can force a little more juice out. If you keep pressing or leave the bruised vegetables under a weight for a few hours, more juice will come out. If the vegetables are not fully submerged by the next morning, or if at any point it seems that water has been lost, and an open crock due to evaporation, simply add a little dechlorinated water. Getting the vegetables submerged is the most critical factor for success in vegetable fermentation. In the salty brine environment, the vegetables have a tendency to float, much like our bodies in the ocean. In a crock, people generally place a weight upon the vegetables to force them down and keep them submerged. One method of accomplishing this in a jar is to cut a chunk of a root vegetable or the heart of a cabbage into the shape of a plug or a disc to place on the surface of the vegetables protruding just a bit from the mouth of the jar. Forcing the lid down and securing it will have the effect of pushing down the plug and the vegetables, keeping all but the plug itself submerged. Some people have fashioned small ceramic or glass weights for this. And a South African company is producing a plastic insert it calls the Visco Disc to keep vegetables submerged in jars. If your weight or plug does not cover the entire surface, resulting in vegetables floating on the surface, don't worry. This is not a problem. If some vegetables on the surface begin to discolor from oxidation or develop surface molds, simply remove and discard them. If you are sealing your ferment in a jar, remember that the fermentation process will produce considerable CO2, which will build pressure inside the jar. Brine may be forced out of the jar through the threads, jar tops may be contorted by the pressure seeking release. Jars have even been known to explode. Release pressure daily in the first few days of fermentation, when CO2 production will be greatest, by simply loosening the jar lid for a moment. After a few days, CO2 will continue to be produced, but at a much slower rate. How long to ferment? Waiting is the hard part. Much of the contemporary literature assumes that we require immediate gratification and recommends fermenting vegetables only 2 or 3 days. Certainly, after 2 or 3 days, the vegetables have begun to be transformed. Taste some at this point. But understand that this is not the full potential of fermented vegetables. Traditionally, fermentation has been a strategy for preserving vegetables for a season or longer. As the days and weeks pass, flavors meld, acidification increases, and textures change. Taste your developing ferment at frequent intervals. Try it at 2 weeks, and if you have any left, at 2 months. I cannot tell you when your kraut cheese will be best. You will have to be the judge of that. Some people love the mild flavors and crunchy textures of an immature green ferment after just a few days. Others prefer the flavors of more mature, longer-aged versions. In warm weather or a heated environment, fermentation will proceed faster than in cooler temperatures. Lower temperatures, at least under 70 degrees Fahrenheit or 21 degrees Celsius, preferably under 65 degrees Fahrenheit or 18 degrees Celsius, ideally 50 to 60 degrees Fahrenheit or 10 to 15 degrees Celsius, make for superior products, writes April McGregor, who ferments vegetables commercially in Carrboro, North Carolina, under the label Farmer's Daughter brand. I've found that by compensating for warmer temperatures with shorter fermentation times, wonderful ferments are possible even at warmer ambient temperatures. Steinkraus et al. Report at length on the influence of temperature. At the low temperature of 7.5 degrees Celsius, 45 degrees Fahrenheit, fermentation is very slow. L. mesenteroides grows slowly, attaining acidity of about 0.4% in about 10 days, and an acidity of 0.8 to 0.9% in a month. The kraut may not be completely fermented for 6 months or more, or until the temperature rises. At a temperature of 18 degrees Celsius, 65 degrees Fahrenheit, with a salt concentration of 2.25%, a total acidity of 1.7 to 2.3% will be attained in about 20 days. At higher temperatures, i.e., 23 degrees Celsius, 73 degrees Fahrenheit, the rate of fermentation will be greater so that a brine acidity of 1.0 to 1.5% may be attained in 8 to 10 days. At a still higher temperature of 32 degrees Celsius, 90 degrees Fahrenheit, the rate of fermentation may be very rapid and an acidity of 1.8 to 2.0% may be attained in 8 to 10 days. The flavor of the kraut will be inferior. It will have a poorer shelf life. Salt also influences fermentation speed. I generally make ferments saltier in summer heat to slow down fermentation, less salty in winter. Some people approach the question of readiness in a strictly utilitarian manner, asking, when is the ferment healthiest? Or, when does it contain the highest number of bacteria? My general impression from reading is that the numbers and concentration of lactic acid bacteria in a vegetable ferment typically follow a bell curve. Populations grow after vegetables are submerged, build to a peak, then decline at high levels of acidity. In addition to the numbers fluctuating, the types of lactic acid bacteria shift as the fermentation proceeds. Rather than thinking about an optimal time to maximize benefit, I believe it makes sense to eat fermenting vegetables at intervals throughout their process as a way of diversifying our bacterial exposure. Whenever you judge your batch of kraut cheese to be ready, moving it to the refrigerator will slow its continued fermentation to an imperceptible pace. Similarly, in a cool spot such as a 55 degrees Fahrenheit or 13 degrees Celsius cellar, vegetables that have been salted and acidified by fermentation can be stable for years. Visiting the Flack family farm in northern Vermont, I was treated to delicious, still crunchy 3-year-old kimchi from a barrel in the cellar. Ferments can also last for years hidden in the back of the refrigerator. In warmer temperatures, fermented vegetables are not quite as stable because eventually pectin-digesting enzymes will activate, making the ferment lose its texture and get mushy. Fermentation enthusiast Hyla Bolsta reflects, "Sometimes a good thing needs to be eaten and finished because it doesn't stay crisp forever. Just as in our lives, sometimes we have to do it now because if we wait, things can get mushy, murky, slimy, etc." Personally, I'm not crazy about fermented vegetables after they get mushy, but some people prefer them that way. I've met several Austrian people who have expressed a preference for soft kraut, and Vicky Phelps wrote to tell me that her partner's dental work makes it impossible for him to eat crunchy vegetables, and so he likes when the ferments get soft. If you desire the ferment to go soft quickly, use little salt and ferment in a warm spot. I ferment vegetables in a barrel in the cellar for 6 months every year, put up in November and eaten through the winter and spring. But by July, with hot summer temperatures, the vegetables lose their crunchiness and get mushy. Vegetables can be fermented deliciously in the tropics or in a heat wave, but they develop fast and don't last for long. The elegance of this is that fermentation preserves vegetables longest in precisely the places where the growing season is shortest, and preserved vegetables are most important. Many people like to can their sauerkraut to preserve it after fermentation. This can be done, but at the sacrifice of live culture benefits. Surface molds and yeasts. The technique of submerging vegetables is a strategy for encouraging the growth of lactic acid bacteria by protecting the vegetables from oxygen, the presence of which promotes the growth of fungi, including both molds and yeasts. An inevitable aspect of this technique is the edge, where, in an open vessel, the surface of the liquid under which the vegetables are submerged typically comes into contact with oxygen-rich air. The meeting at this boundary of the nutritious vegetable juices and the air encourages a rich biodiversity, where molds and yeasts frequently develop. Surface growth is common and normal, it should be removed, but it is not cause for alarm and it does not ruin your fermenting vegetables. The aerobic yeasts that develop are distinct from the molds, though a surface layer of yeast can become a layer of mold. The yeast layer that frequently develops on the surface of fermenting vegetables is known as calm yeast. The life of yeasts describes: during the lactic acid fermentation, a characteristic fermentative yeast flora develops in the liquid. When the sugar is used up and the pH has dropped because of lactic acid production by the lactic acid bacteria, a secondary oxidative yeast flora develops on the surface of the liquid in the form of a thick, folded layer of yeast. The calm yeast layer is beige in color, with a dramatic texture, something like waves or a plate of spaghetti. Mold typically develops as a white film at first. It is not important to be able to distinguish between calm yeasts and molds. Surface discoloration can be caused by simple oxidation as well. Any growth or discoloration that develops on the surface of your fermenting vegetables should be removed. To get rid of surface growth, gently remove weight from the ferment. Use a wide stainless steel spoon to get under the mold and skim it off as best you can. Depending on how wet or dry the ferment is, you may need to remove the plate or interior lid in order to skim growth off. Sometimes it is not possible to remove all the mold because as you attempt to remove it, the mold dissipates and little bits are left remaining. If this happens, remove most of it as much as you can and don't worry. As long as the mold is white, it is not harmful. If other color molds start to grow, do not eat them. Bright colors often indicate sporulation, the mold's reproductive stage. To prevent spreading the spores, gently lift the entire mold mass from your ferment. Fortunately, the occasional colorful molds I have encountered, always preceded by white molds, were cohesive and easily removed in their entirety. The longer you allow a mold to grow on the surface of your ferment, the deeper its mycelia penetrate. Molds can digest pectins, leading to mushy vegetables. Eventually, the vegetables can come to taste like mold. Molds can also digest lactic acid, lowering the acidity of the ferment that enables it to be effectively preserved. Remove mold or other surface growth as best you can, as soon as you notice it. After removing mold, evaluate the texture of the underlying vegetables. If the vegetables near the surface have been softened by mold growth, remove and discard. Some people like to use outer cabbage leaves as a barrier between the shredded vegetables and the surface. In a jar, simply fold a leaf to fit. In a larger vessel, most people who do this arrange leaves in an overlapping circle or spiral. Fermentation enthusiast Lisa Milton wrote describing another technique. I use the outside cabbage leaves that I would normally compost, wash them thoroughly and roll them up very tightly to a cigar shape. Then I place them side by side on top of the veggie mixture. When the veggies are nice and fermented, I remove the rolled up cabbage leaves and toss them. Oftentimes I will find mold growing on top of the cabbage, but the veggies are not affected at all. Another strategy some people use to protect the surface of the ferment from air exposure is covering it with a layer of olive oil. The most effective way to avoid surface growths is to protect the surface of the ferment from exposure to air. People do this with heavy plastic bags filled with water or brine that can spread to cover the full surface of a vessel, or with specially designed crocks or jar lids. If you are fermenting in an open vessel, be aware that water can evaporate, especially in a dry climate or a heated space. Check fluid levels periodically and add water as necessary. If you peel mold off a dry top layer of vegetables, you may need to also compost the top layer of vegetables. Remove any vegetables that seem dry or discolored. Keep veggies submerged. It gets better. Luke Regalbuto and Maggie Levenger make and sell fermented vegetables in Northern California under the label Wild West Ferments. We often hear stories of people throwing away whole batches because it smells or looks bad at first sight. We have found beautiful kraut under a moldy, maggot-infested top layer. It was delicious. People should know that an offensive odor often decreases and sometimes even disappears once a crock is packed into jars and refrigerated. Which vegetables can be fermented? Shredded cabbage is certainly not the whole story. The simple process of vegetable fermentation is extremely versatile. There is no vegetable that cannot be fermented. That is not to say that all vegetables will ferment equally well, or that all vegetables will taste good fermented. Some vegetables get mushy faster than others during fermentation, cucumbers, summer squash. These vegetables I only use in small batches that I eat quickly rather than aging them. Dark green leafy vegetables rich in chlorophyll, kale, collards, and other greens will develop a very strong characteristic flavor during fermentation, which you may or may not like. Annika Dunnington of Southern Coastal Oregon writes, "I personally am terrified of what happens when I try to ferment kale. Every time it ends up smelling like the worst dead thing I have ever smelled." I limit dark greens to minor ingredients in mixed vegetable ferments. In that context, I find them to be delicious. When they stand alone, their flavor is too strong for me. Rick Chumley of Tennessee writes that his favorite batch mixed half kale and half cabbage into super green sauerkraut. The most popular vegetables to ferment for long storage are cold weather vegetables that are harvested late in the season as temperatures are cooling, such as cabbages or radishes. The significance of cool temperatures is that they facilitate a slow fermentation and long storage. Vegetables harvested and fermented in summer heat tend to ferment fast and do not lend themselves as well to long-term storage. Personally, I especially love to ferment root vegetables, including radishes, carrots, turnips, beets, parsnips, rutabaga, celery root, parsley root, and earthy burdock. A large proportion of beets, being so sugary, can encourage a yeasty fermentation and produce thick, syrupy brine. But Marcy King writes, "I love fermented beets with horseradish, onion, garlic, and dill. Typically, I scrub but do not peel root vegetables. The stems of leafy vegetables, such as chard and bok choy, often discarded during preparation, also ferment well. Celery does too. If you enjoy okra, try fermenting some. I usually use okra whole, mixing them with shredded vegetables. That way their sliminess remains mostly enclosed within them, so the people, like me, who enjoy that can, while others can simply avoid the okra. If you chop the okra with other vegetables, the whole batch can take on okra's slime. Yum. All kinds of peppers ferment well, sweet or hot, fresh or dried, smoked or roasted. More on peppers in hot sauce later. So do eggplants. Some people salt and drain the eggplants first. Personally, I have found that the bitterness of the eggplants is removed by fermentation. People ferment tomatoes, green and red, brined green tomatoes, which can get very sour, are a Jewish delicatessen staple. In addition to all varieties of cabbages, Brussels sprouts, cauliflower, kohlrabi, broccoli, and other brassica vegetables ferment beautifully. So do other greens, such as chard, especially their stalks, as do fresh green, yellow, or purple beans. I've enjoyed fermented fiddlehead ferns, bamboo shoots, pumpkins and winter squash, nopales, cactus pads, and shiitake and other mushrooms. My friend Nuri E. Amazon writes that spaghetti squash in a brine with lots of garlic is one of the best ferments ever. Brined watermelon rinds rival cucumbers as sour pickles in both flavor and texture. Corn, too, can be fermented as a vegetable. Dawn Beely wrote from Italy about her experiences fermenting artichokes. I only used the hearts and sliced them very thinly. They turned out great. Even my 13-month-old and 4-year-old ate them. Jerusalem artichokes, no relation but rather delicious, earthy, starchy tubers, Helianthus tuberosus, sometimes known as sunchokes, also ferment beautifully, and the fermentation digests the inulin, a long-chain carbohydrate, in them that can give people gas, though inulin is considered prebiotic because it feeds our intestinal bacteria so well, hence the gas. The biggest challenge with using Jerusalem artichokes is cleaning their knobby nooks and crannies. I find it helps to break them apart as much as possible and then blast them with a hose for a couple rinses, advises Annika Dunnington. You need not limit yourself to cultivated vegetables. Lagusta Yearwood and others rave about fermenting wild spring ramps, otherwise known as wild leeks, or in the UK as ramson. Ramps, with their funky potency, are ideally matched with the fermentation process. Those magical bacteria simultaneously tame and heighten the bright umami richness of those beautiful wild greens. Eat something wild every day, was the advice of my friend Frank Cook as he encouraged people to get to know and interact with common plants around them. I try to visit the garden every day to graze on weeds as well as vegetables. While I'm not always sure where the weeds end and the wild edibles start, sometimes I incorporate them into my ferments, though typically as minor elements. In Eastern Europe, an umbelliferous weed known as barshk, in Slavic languages, Heraclium species, has historically been fermented and used in soups, giving us the soup called borscht in English, now typically made with beets. Lita Meredith, author of The Locavore's Handbook, writes in an email, I like mixing in foraged ingredients such as garlic mustard seed, spice bush berries, and wild ginger. Finnish fermentation enthusiast Asi Kako describes ferments featuring stinging nettles, whole dandelion flowers, dandelion leaves, plantain leaves, and lamb's quarters. Some more bitter leaves can turn mild through fermentation, he observes. Maria Tarantino, an Italian fermentation experimentalist who lives in Belgium, elaborates that very bitter leaves generally release a bouquet of flavors in the fermenting crock, as if the bitterness opens up to more subtle components. Of the wild herbs she has tried, so far the most amazing was wild sea fennel, in Italian critmo, a cactus-like plant that grows on the rocks at the seaside and which is already slightly salted. The flowers are very bitter, but if you wait long enough, the hard edge softens. Another favorite is egopode, Egopodium podagraria, known in English as ground elder, goutweed, or snow in the mountain, a plant that has celery-like stems that are perfumed and exotic. Seaweed is a delicious mineral-rich ingredient to add to ferments. I prepare seaweed by covering it with just a little water and squeezing it with my hands. After a few minutes, the seaweed hydrates and becomes soft and pliable. I chop the hydrated seaweed and add it, along with any extra juice, to other vegetables. Krautmaker Elizabeth Hopkins suggests using kelp or other green seaweeds rather than reddish dulse. Dulse completely disintegrated and turned my otherwise palatable ferment into a brown sewage-looking mess, she writes. Should have definitely used kelp. Fruits can be another exciting addition. Eastern European traditions often add apples, raisins, or cranberries to sauerkraut. You could also add hints of citrus fruits or juice, or other fruits, berries, pineapples, plums. Luke Regalbuto, a California kraut maker, reports, dried fruit and kraut, for example dried blueberries, hold up much better in the crock than fresh ones. Greg Olma adds quinces to his sauerkraut. Every 5 pounds I add the pickling salt, about a cup of sliced and cleaned quinces with a pinch of coriander seed, a few whole cloves, some black peppercorns, a few allspice berries, and a pinch of fennel and anise seeds. I love to add seasonal berries and shredded green papaya when it comes my way to vegetable ferments. Nuts, too, can embellish fermented vegetables. I especially like the textural variation they contribute. In the Korean tradition, fish are often added to vegetables in the preparation of kimchi. Raw, small, fresh, or dried fish, shrimp, oysters, and other fish are added, as well as fermented fish sauce. The raw fish transforms during acidification in the fermented kimchi, as in citrus-cured ceviche. The fish develops the appearance and texture of cooked fish. In some inland regions of Korea, meat and meat stock are also used in kimchi. Fresh vegetables can be supplemented with mung or other bean sprouts, rice or other cooked grains, potatoes steamed, mashed, or fried, and other cooked ingredients. I tried a delicious edamame kimchi with steamed green edamame, a type of soybean served in the pod, among the more commonly found vegetables. I've thrown the crusty remains of fried potatoes into kraut with very pleasing results. A friend of mine even added peeled hard-boiled eggs to a mixed vegetable ferment, and after absorbing red from beets, they were not only tasty, but beautiful. When incorporating cooked foods, cool to body temperature before adding. And because cooked foods generally do not contain significant lactic acid bacteria, they are rarely fermented alone, without some sort of raw ingredient for culturing. Still, as a minor element in a mostly raw mix, they work fine. You can ferment vegetables past their prime and beginning to soften or wilt. If there is any mold on the surface, cut it away and discard. Fermenting is not the same as rotting. Be judicious. The worst kraut I ever made was from a box of pre-shredded cabbage, carrots, and onions from Kentucky Fried Chicken, intended for coleslaw. My friend Max Zine, a dedicated food rescuer, obtained several such boxes from a local food bank's distribution and gave me one. The veggies were not rotted at all, but I suspect they must have been sprayed with some kind of preservative chemical, because the fermentation appeared not to proceed at all, and it tasted awful. Nonetheless, fermentation is a great strategy for dumpster divers, gleaners, and others who find themselves with abundant supplies of vegetables others have rejected. In general, I would advise against adding additional ingredients to a batch of krautchi that has been fermenting for a while. The older vegetables can begin to soften just as the newly added vegetables are developing their flavor. If you have a fresh supply of vegetables, start a fresh batch. It's fine to have several batches at different stages of development fermenting simultaneously. Northeast Kingdom krautchi. Justin Lander, East Hardwick, Vermont, in the Northeast Kingdom. After a few years of experimenting with kitchen sink mixed vegetable ferments, known as MVF, in our house, I decided to try to make a regionally appropriate Northeast Kingdom kimchi. The main inspiration for the recipe came while working in a friend's sugar bush, another name for maple forest, where at the end of sugaring season ramps grow abundantly. Mixed in the ramps there are large patches of wild ginger. These two ingredients are the base. Then I add dandelion greens and roots, burdock root, salt, and sometimes dried hot pepper from the previous year. I let it ferment for several weeks. The exciting thing about this stuff is that it comes out sweet and perfumey. It's almost a dessert kraut. Spicing. The spicing of fermented vegetables is similarly versatile. Vegetables can be fermented unadulterated, mildly spiced, or as strong as you can take it. Kimchi is typically spiced with hot peppers, ginger, garlic, and onions, scallions, shallots, or leeks. Often the hot pepper is added in the form of powder or flakes, though it can also be used fresh, dried, or as hot sauce. German tradition often spices sauerkraut with juniper berries. Caraway, dill, and celery seeds are other popular sauerkraut herbs. In El Salvador, curtido is spiced with oregano and hot pepper. Functionally, most of the traditional spices used in fermentation, mentioned above, act as mold inhibitors. This does not mean that molds cannot ever grow in their presence, just that they slow mold growth. If two open crocks are placed side by side in the same environment, with the same vegetables and the same salinity, differing only in the addition of spices to one, the spiced batch will always be slower to develop surface molds than the plain, unspiced batch. Another mold inhibitor and spicy ferment ingredient is nasturtium leaves. Feel free to depart from tradition. Turmeric adds a great flavor and color, as well as antioxidant, antiviral, and other medicinal qualities to fermenting vegetables. Cumin is lovely in a ferment, as is lightly toasted oregano. People have written to me citing black pepper, coriander, fennel, fenugreek, and mustard seeds as favorites. Some of the flavors of fresh herbs tend to be somewhat volatile, so they may not persist over the period of a long fermentation, but in shorter ferments they can be delicious, and it can't hurt to try. Fermented herb mix. Monique Trahan lives in western Massachusetts on a farmlet with gardens, dairy goats, chickens, and pastured pigs, within sight of the biggest shopping center in town. I make fresh herb salad dressing mix in late summer and fall and use it all winter. I use whatever is growing in abundance, but my favorite is mostly basil, lots of oregano, parsley, scallion/chives, garlic, and a bit of hot pepper. Chop/mince, I use the chopping blade on my food processor. Add brine, salty is good with this as it is used as a flavoring ingredient, and ferment at room temperature for 3 days or so. Then move it to the fridge for storage, although we are building a root cellar this year. It is so easy to plop a spoonful into a cruet with vinegar and olive oil for a quick dressing, or into some drained kefir for a creamy dressing or dip. It can also go into soups and such for a very quick jolt of summer. I call it Seasons of Refreshing, and it is a hit with guests. Sauerkraut. The best-known style of fermented vegetables in the United States and much of Europe is sauerkraut. Sauerkraut consists primarily of shredded cabbage and salt. Often the shredded cabbage is spiced with juniper berries or caraway seeds. In some traditions, fruits such as apples or cranberries are added. I met a woman whose grandmother was from a town in Poland where everyone added mashed potatoes to their sauerkraut. The potatoes take on the flavor of the sauerkraut and lend it a distinctive, varied texture. Be sure to cool the mashed potatoes before adding. I often mix red cabbage with the white cabbage to yield bright pink kraut. It is actually quite possible to add many varied minor ingredients while still maintaining the essential qualities of sauerkraut by making sure it is made mostly from shredded cabbage. The process is the generic Krautchi method, with dry salting. One iconic sauerkraut is the Bavarian style, in which the sauerkraut is made with caraway seeds and served sweet, typically mixed with sugar and warmed before serving. Another traditional German sauerkraut variation is Weinkraut, made with the addition of sweet white wine. What a miracle that turned out to be, recounts Judith Orth of New Hampshire. The fermentation process transformed a lousy wine into a lovely, subtly elusive flavor, everyone's favorite batch by far. Many traditions of kraut making, and fermentation more broadly, use the phases of the moon to determine the best time to prepare it. A woman who lives near me in Reddyville, Tennessee, shared with me her grandmother Ruby Reddy's sauerkraut recipe. The secret, of course, is to make it in the light of the moon, while the moon is growing, and that way it will never shrink or get dark. Folklore traditions being widely varied, I have also encountered conflicting advice, suggesting that the best time to make sauerkraut is when the moon is waning. To be honest, I have made sauerkraut throughout the moon's phases and have never observed any differences based on that. The techniques of sauerkraut have already been covered. I have been struck through the years by the number of stories people have shared about the significance of sauerkraut in their lives. For instance, Larissa Biley of Indianapolis, Indiana, writes, "My parents were born and grew up in Russia. I learned from my dad that after World War II, he, age 8, and his family literally survived on sauerkraut and potatoes for a year. There really was no other food, and he is still healthy today at 70, and still loves sauerkraut." Christina Haverill Tamburo of Andover, Connecticut, reports that one of my great-grandmothers, who came to Bridgeport in 1908, was so kraut-obsessed that a cabbage cutter was the only thing she brought with her to this country, besides a few clothes in a sack. My great-aunt is still using the cutter. Many barns, basements, and attics hold similar old kraut-shredding boards and crocks, which were so vitally important to people's lives in the past but have fallen into disuse. Find them, clean them up, and put them back to work. The case of the kraut called hooch. My friend D spent some time in a federal prison. D likes to eat well and decided to try to make sauerkraut. She did it by rinsing off the prison coleslaw, salting it, and weighing it down with an orange. Unfortunately, when it was discovered by guards, they accused her of trying to make hooch. Her mother wrote to me. They immediately confiscated it, tested and analyzed it for content and scent, the preliminary breath test registered nothing, but still determined she was absolutely making hooch with illegal contraband. They wrote her up, required her to submit a written statement explaining herself, and charged her with making liquor. At the hearing, Dee clearly presented her facts and intention, and they understood her to be truthful, especially after reviewing all her previous dietary requests. Her charges were changed from a major to a minor offense, nothing to darken her prison record, and Dee was sentenced to 1 day of segregation. Dee has long since been released and can ferment to her heart's content, and her belly's at home.